Every faith has a salvation story. In Judaism, that salvation story is the Exodus, which Passover celebrates. It's a journey from slavery and death and oppression to a new world, a new life, a new opportunity to create something better, to experience something better. It's a journey from the west, a place where the sun sets in a land of darkness, to the east and a new sunrise and a new day. It goes across all kinds of perils, many of which you are familiar with from at least the movies, if not the book. And you know Charlton Heston, and not really a very convincing Moses in my view, but that's another story. A better Ben-Hur than a... Anyway, you have all of the stories that we're really familiar with Moses, with God troubling the waters, and I'll get to that. But that's the salvation story. It's from death to life, from darkness to light. And it involves adventures, it involves food, it involves water and drink and rebellion and all the sorts of things that real human beings and nations and peoples go through. The Seder, which is celebrated in Israel on one day, but outside of Israel on two different nights, is a meal that tells a story. And food, of course, is very central to Judaism, and it is also very central to Christianity, not to mention Islam. You have in all of our salvation stories the centrality of the meal, of food, of sharing, of an appreciation of the miracle of life. That Seder is, of course, central to Christianity because the Last Supper, which will be commemorated later in this week, was a Seder meal. It was celebrating, observing the Passover. And so that meal is central to Christianity, to sit at a table and to share bread and to share it as, in Christian terms, living bread. What happens in these two stories is that they are both journeys from darkness to light and from death to life. In the Jewish version of the Exodus, they're told on a horizontal plane as a physical journey. In the Christian sense, the journey is taken from the horizontal and it's moved to the vertical. A new covenant to a new Jerusalem, to the idea that with many of the same stories and images, and if not facts, at least truths, that people can learn to have a sense of their own freedom and be able to examine and acknowledge those things, those values that are important, really even central. It is fair, I suppose, to ask what the Unitarian salvation story is, and we are not surprisingly a little perverse. Unitarian history is pretty much a journey from the east to the west, where everything else is from the west to the east. I remember my wife asking me a couple of years ago, does Easter have anything to do with east? Well, yes, the sunrise. We have been on a journey from Transylvania to France to England, to New England, to California, to Hawaii, and our westward journey is still taking place. But we also affirm the centrality of food. To just mess with Doug Adams a little bit, who said that the stages of history were how shall we eat, to what shall we eat, to where shall we dine. The history of religion, to some extent, has been from the Seder to the Last Supper to the first coffee hour. So we're at least part of that holy celebration of food, coffee, caffeine, and occasionally a little bit of wine. The explanation of what Passover is very simple. The sage Hillel said that all that is necessary for a Passover Seder is that the elements on the celebration plate are explained and the story of the Passover is told. The elements on the plate should be very familiar, many of them, to people of all faiths. It starts out with a lamb bone whose image is central to both Judaism and Christianity in terms of what salvation means. In Judaism, it was marking the houses, the doorposts of the houses, with blood of sacrificed lambs so that the angel of death would pass over. And in Christianity, it is salvation by the blood of the Lamb in Agnus Dei, in the form of Jesus. The images are parallel images. And whatever our sense and sensibilities are around issues of blood and sacrifice, they have been central to our three major monotheistic religions, where, in fact, in Islam, lambs are still slaughtered at Eid, al-Fitr, to commemorate the sacrifice in Islam of a lamb instead of Ishmael. In the Muslim story, it's Ishmael. In the Jewish story, it's Isaac. But the same images in all three faiths acknowledge this deal that we make with life and death. The other elements on the Seder plate are an egg. This might be familiar to people next week as an Easter egg, because an egg is a sign and symbol of fertility, of life coming out of seemingly nowhere. You take this shell that doesn't seem to be beating. It doesn't gestate. You can't put your ear to it and, well, for the most part, you can't. If in any of your refrigerators you can put your ear to the egg and you hear something, check with an audiologist. But what they looked at the egg as a symbol of fertility, a symbol of the great gift of life and of birth. There's the bitter herb to remind people of the beautiful bounty of the earth, but also of some of the bitterness that everyone tastes eventually in life. There's a cup of salted water to remind us of the tears of oppression, the tears that slaves shed, not just the slaves in Egypt, but the slaves, the oppressed, the downtrodden, the persecuted of all times and all ages. That's not simply a ritual, but it's a reminder of the history of human suffering and the present human suffering in the world. There's also the horseradish, which brings tears to the eyes, again reminding people of the bitterness of oppression. And there's the maror, an ambivalent, meaning a symbol that goes in two directions, which is chopped apples and, depending on the culture, nuts, raisins, dates, a little bit of wine mixed in. And that is symbolic of the mortar that was used to build the pyramids. But it's also sweet and delicious, and that's why it's ambivalent, that it reminds you of a bad time, but it also has a sweetness to it that reminds you that we get past bad times. And those are the essential elements that need to be explained. So now you've been to half a Seder today. The other half is telling the story. And the story parallels what goes on in the Christian story, or foretells. They're essentially so close. You have in Egypt the Hebrews who are slaves. And they don't enjoy that for some reason that I think everybody can pretty much understand. And they want to get out of there. And Moses, who won't get into all the scholarship, who may or may not have been an Egyptian or a Hebrew. There are lots of reasons given why he doesn't speak to the people in Hebrew. He was raised in the palace. He stutters. He burned his mouth. The elephant ate his homework. Those usual sorts of things. And he goes to the slaves and says, you know, let's get out of here. And they say, come on. We're slaves, but slavery has stability. We don't know. It could be worse out there in the desert. You sure we want to give up the flesh pots of Egypt? And the Hebrew slaves were not at all certain. They had to be organized. They had to be inspired. They had to believe that something better could be out there in their future, if not for themselves, then for their children. And as you know in the story, they organized. They went to Pharaoh and said, "Let us go." And Pharaoh said, "No." They went back again, and the drama builds, and finally they're let go after the plagues have struck down the Egyptians. It's a very full contact story. And they get out and don't have time. Oh, I left out the symbol of the matzah, which is also on the plate. They don't have time to bake bread, to wait for the leavening to let it rise, because they figured the Egyptians might conceivably break their promise, which they did. And so they had that first meal in freedom, the crackers of matzah, and then hightailed it to the Red Sea. And the Red Sea was standing there, and they were standing there, and they needed a miracle. Now, everybody kind of go with the story for a second, because the one greatest change in my life, my religious life over the 45 years that I have been a clergy person, is that I used to look at Bible stories as true or false. It happened or it didn't happen. But over a period of time, I see the stories from Hebrew scriptures, from the Gospels, from the Pauline materials, from the Quran, not to be true or false factually, but whether there are truths, complex truths that we can find, complex metaphors that can touch us and inform us and make a difference to us. So when we sang today, "God's Going to Trouble the Waters," the story is that they came up to the Red Sea and looked at that and said, "Oy, we did not have a lot of swimming lessons back then." And water, in fact, is another one of those, hang on for it again, ambivalent symbols. Because it is clearly a source of life. It gives food, it gives life. We are made up mostly of water, and you need to have it. On the other hand, the ancient Hebrews were not sailors. They were not seafaring people. The ancient Hebrews were not Phoenicians or Greeks. They were a desert people. And Jews did not become a seafaring people until they got to Long Island and later Marina del Rey. Then things changed. But in ancient times, it was the desert. And in the desert, a rainstorm could have those wadis fill up and sweep people away. Water was life and water was death. In fact, in a pre-biblical Sumerian creation story, God wrestles the waters for 5 days of creation before getting them into shape in order to create the dry land and human beings. One of the ways that God shows who God is by controlling water. If water is chaos and water is death, the power to control it shows up when the Hebrews get to the Red Sea and God parts the waters. In a subsequent Talmudic story, God doesn't simply part the waters. They don't just walk up there and go, "Oh, cool, there's a nice channel here." But Nachshon has to believe that the waters will part, and a human being has to take the first step. When a human being took the first step, then the waters parted. The most important message in all of the sermon, even if it goes on another hour and a quarter, is that in the biblical stories of both Testaments, human beings are partners in their own salvation. Nachshon has to take a step. The Hebrews didn't just sit there and wait to be rescued, but they had to get up and get out and take some real risks. The stories you see do parallel. You have the 12 tribes of Israel coming out. You have the 12 apostles of Jesus. You have many of the same names. You have birth stories. You have miracles of food and water. God doesn't simply part the sea, but later on in the story, Moses strikes a rock and brings forth water. And people are nourished by that. In the Gospels, Jesus does a one-upsmanship on Moses and says, they gave you water. Watch this, wine. And very good marketing, I have to say. Which is why Unitarians are usually put over in the Protestant camp when they're trying to sort these things out with our commitment to wine, as opposed to Manischewitz, which really, technically, as far as anybody who drinks wine, really isn't wine. It's something that you whine about every year. It's part of the tradition of suffering. But you also have the food. You have the food where the people are taken care of. It's manna from heaven. And manna from heaven turns out not to be delicious. The word manna comes from the Hebrew word, and I am not making this up, manu. What is it? It did not translate as breadfruit. It was very nice. But God, who freed us from slavery, God who created the world, you call this a meal? This is what we get in the cafeteria. So what happens in Numbers, when the story is kind of added to, when the Sabbath is given, the people who keep the Sabbath, the manna turns delicious. It's flavored with honey and cardamom. And for the people that don't keep the Sabbath, it becomes rancid. But it's food and water, which then gets paralleled in the gospel story when Jesus controls the water by walking on it, turning water into wine, and the miracle of the fish and loaves, where the says, you know, you people eat and you're still hungry. I'm going to give you spiritual food and you won't be hungry. And he feeds everybody with 5 loaves of bread. Don't look for the naturalistic explanation. There are people that say, well, you know, back then they were really big loaves. They had ovens and you could have a loaf of bread that would feed multitudes and 5. You'd have plenty left over for sandwiches. You had other people who looked and said, no, they made really small portions. It's spiritual bread. It's about what we take into our hearts and souls. And it doesn't mean you don't need physical bread, but it does mean that we are more than just the meat. We have emotional, spiritual needs that also need to be nourished. And so the miracle of the loaves is, I'm going to give you bread, and you're not going to be hungry anymore. Don't look for the naturalistic explanation. He was giving them matzah, and they just said they weren't hungry because they didn't want to eat any more of it. Bread is central to the religions. It is not accidental, scripturally, that Rachel is buried in Bethlehem, that in the Gospels, Jesus is born in Bethlehem, because the translation in Hebrew of Bethlehem is Beth Lechem, the house of bread. And bread is central to the sacrament and salvation. The wonderful Italian Catholic communist writer, only in Italy are those not contradictions, Ignazio Salone, said that it is true that to the poor, God comes in the form of bread. Bread is salvation. Feeding each other. Our crop walk is an act of salvation. Our food baskets are salvation. When somebody is hungry and suffering, giving them food is saving them. It's about saving lives. We need to care about our spiritual insides, but you also got to stay alive as best you can. And that's what these holidays and holy days celebrate. That there are perils. You all know all of the perils out on the desert for 40 years. There are problems that you have. The people revolted, and Moses went up to the mountaintop, and the most remarkable moment in Hebrew scriptures takes place. Moses goes to the mountaintop, gets the laws, comes back down, and the people have lost their faith. they have melted their jewelry and made a golden calf that they are worshiping. And Moses is a little upset. He smashes the tablets and he goes back up and says to God, I'm going to wipe these people out. What am I going to do with these bull-headed, stiff-necked people? And God says to Moses, you got a point, Moshe. I'll wipe them out. And all of a sudden, Moses goes, whoa, I was just blowing off steam, Lord. I didn't really mean it. You didn't really free them from slavery just to kill them now. You didn't part the Red Sea just to kill them now. You didn't feed them manna from heaven just to kill them now. And God repents of his evil idea. What a remarkable scripture. In all the scriptures of the Hebrew Bible, and I'll get to gospel next week at Easter, but of all of the moments in the Hebrew Bible, God being able to change his mind. Don't look at it literally. Look at it what it means to us. If we are stiff-necked and proud, if we can't say, whoops, I'm sorry, if we get stuck in positions, well, I told him I would have to do this punishment, and I can't look bad, I can't back down. The scriptural moment of truth when God says, well, you know, what was I thinking? I just don't know. Is very powerful. It gives us permission to look at our hard-edged positions, to re-examine what we have said, what we have wanted, what we have threatened, and say, okay, is this really a good idea? Or can I say, maybe I was just blowing off a little steam here, and I can turn away, turn back from a path that I took in a moment of passion or anger and unreason. This is really central to me and my understanding of these stories. Almost finally, the real heart of the story and of my change in attitude over time is to see the complexities of biblical interpretation. You're looking at a birth story. Most people are conceived in relative darkness, either ambient darkness, with or without Johnny Mathis playing, and the fetus grows up in a womb, normally a dark place, is born to the light through a canal. Look at the parting of the Red Sea as a canal. In the Hebrew, the place is Mitzrayim, which means a tight, squeezed place. It's clearly a birth story. Did not have to wait for either Freud or Jung to understand that imagery. From darkness through a canal to light and to life. Rebelling. Many of you may have rebelled in your younger years, driven your parents into thoughts of murder, and that they mostly turned away from and said, well, okay, it was an impulse, but a bad idea. And then you pair up, you have your own family, and you come to another river, as the Hebrews did, that we can't cross over. And that's for our children. So that when you're looking at the Passover story, you're looking at a story of the birth or rebirth of a people, but you're also looking at the story of the birth, the story of the adolescence, the story of the adulthood, the story of the deaths and the journeys of all people. Born, struggling, rebelling, growing up, taking some responsibility, and then coming to a river that you cannot cross, but your children and your grandchildren can. When we look at all the various pilgrim stories, whether it was the Hebrews on the Exodus, or whether it was the pilgrims who came out of England and Holland to come here, whether it was the slaves on the Underground Railroad going north and taking chances, were these risks, these sacrifices worth it? And the answer is not necessarily for the lives and comfort of the pilgrims, but it was done for the children. When we look and ask, what would we give up? What would we sacrifice? What journey, spiritual or physical, would we go on and risk all, lose all? And there's only one good reason to undertake any of those things, and it isn't for our own comfort or pleasure. It is for the sake of the future, our direct children or our spiritual children. Whether or not we have kids, we have kids. And our connection, what keeps us in the game, is the fact that the future, to some extent, is in our hands. And the values that we examine, the sacrifices that we make, the risks that we take for the sake of having air and water and planet, food and justice, these are the classic issues for which human beings pledge their lives, their fortune, their sacred honor. And so what's the meaning of the Passover? I think the choir said it pretty nicely. Invest your love. Invest your life today for the sake of tomorrow. It is the story of Passover. It's the story of Easter. It's the story of Eid. It is the human story.